archaeological expeditions, and we had cause to be grateful. A lack of proper security meant no watchman and no dog to stop us. As we moved near to the house, we saw a progression of lights as Sir Leicester and his captive moved through. At first a distant glow, the golden nimbus of a lamp grew brighter as they came to the back. We could hear Sir Leicester's voice raised as he berated Fairbrother, giving vent to his temper. We paused only a moment in the shadow of a shrubbery to get our bearings. The bushes led us up to the edge of a French window, undraped. Through the glass, we could see Fairbrother, sitting in a chair, his expression wary as he kept his eye upon Sir Leicester and the lethal black revolver in his hand. To my astonishment, Stoker rose slowly from the shadow of the shrubbery, openly approaching the window.
"What are you doing?"
Henry asked in a high voice.
"If we surprise him, he may shoot," Stoker explained. "Better to give him a moment to accustom himself to the idea that he has visitors."
He did not bother to lower his voice, and Fairbrother's instant glance in the direction of the window drew Sir Leicester's attention. He started from the chair, and Sir Leicester waved him back, menacing him with the revolver as Stoker slowly opened the door, followed hard by me, Henry Steele bringing up the rear reluctantly.
"What the devil are you lot doing here?"
Sir Leicester demanded. All traces of good humour vanished.
"We came at Lady Tiverton's insistence," Stoker replied calmly. "She is rather afraid you might do something foolish."
He deliberately circled to the left while I moved to the right, dividing Sir Leicester's focus. The baronet was not to be so easily deceived. He jerked the revolver from one of us to the other.
"No, stand together,"
he ordered. "Surely you do not mean to shoot us," I said plainly. "It is far too late for that. The game is up. Much better for you to take the consequences like a man." His ruddy complexion was florid.
"Consequences? Of what? Letting myself be duped by this blackguard?"
he demanded, turning the gun once more upon Fairbrother.
"That's a bit rough, don't you think?"
Fairbrother asked in a casual tone of voice.
"We did agree to this scheme together, after all. You were perfectly happy to undertake it when we began." "Happy? How could I be happy when you were always there, goading me to do more, to risk more? I wanted only to make a little money. But you have taken a harmless little business dealing and made it something grotesque. It is your fault that I have risked my honour,"
he lamented. Any sympathy I might have had for the man was fast evaporating. He seemed far more concerned for his own name than for John de Morgan's life. But I could well imagine Patrick Fairbrother nudging him to the precipice of these crimes, then tipping him gently over the edge. I was thoroughly annoyed at myself for ever thinking him charming, and not a little chagrined that I had failed to consider him earlier in the role of the mastermind of this pernicious plot. I did not like to think that a sturdy pair of shoulders and a handsome smile might have compromised my judgment, so I dismissed the thought at once and turned my attention to provoking a confession. "You arranged John de Morgan's death at the hotel in Dover, did you not?" I asked Fairbrother softly. "It was to be the culmination of the mummy's curse. Proof, along with the appearance of Anubis, that the expedition had discovered something unique in all of Egyptology. Tell me how you managed it. I presume you had some connection to the hotel's proprietress."
"His sister,"
Sir Leicester supplied, levelling the revolver at Fairbrother's chest. Fairbrother's eyes cut sharply to me, but he was careful to keep his voice casual, perhaps sensing that we were all that stood between him and the angry baronet.
"Yes, Rebecca Giddens is my sister."
"Rebecca F. Giddens," I mouthed at Stoker, as Fairbrother went on.
Her hotel was failing, so when I took the position with Sir Leicester, I arranged for the expedition to stay with her. I thought she would benefit from it. She did, Stoker remarked. So much that she felt obliged to help you when you conspired to remove John de Morgan. He gave you the perfect opportunity to kill two birds, if you will pardon the expression, with one stone. He found the diadem while you were digging, and when you pretended to discover it in the tomb, he realized what you were doing. He became a threat to your scheme, and he had to be eliminated.
I looked at Fairbrother. Redecorating the room was a particularly cruel touch. I suppose it bothered you not at all to think that you might drive Mrs. de Morgan mad with such a trick.
She had to be discredited, Fairbrother said slowly. If her story was plausible, the authorities would ask too many questions. But if she told a thoroughly unbelievable story, then she would be written off as a madwoman. And with John de Morgan ostensibly at large, no one could prove that he was not responsible if the fakery ever came to light. You eliminated a witness and established a scapegoat at a single stroke, Stoker said. All to hide what you were doing, creating a fake Egyptological find where none existed.
How do you know that?
Sir Leicester demanded, his colour rising hotly. Something Horace Steele said, I told him, that he could sell a clay flower pot so long as he could persuade someone it belonged to Amenhotep. That is precisely what you were doing, wasn't it? You pretended to find an incomplete grave complete with a mummy. That gave the find a certain cachet, and the notion of a curse prevented people from asking too many questions, or becoming too suspicious when the body count began to grow. In the meantime, you would exhibit your treasures and then sell them privately for astronomical sums. Cheap reproductions, netting you a fortune.
Did you even bother to put the goods into the grave?
Stoker asked.
No, wait. We already know the answer to that, don't we, Veronica?
He directed the baronet's attention to me just long enough to move himself forwards an inch.
You didn't. That's why you needed workers from upriver, strangers who wouldn't talk in the valley villages giving away your secret. You paid off the Egyptian authorities with a few real artifacts from earlier expeditions. It meant sacrificing your own collection, but that would be a small price to pay for the fortune you stood to make from the sale of the exhibition. You could charge astronomical prices, and no one would blink at paying them.
I continued the narrative, turning an accusing eye upon Sir Leicester. The only item you needed to produce, with theatrical flourish, was the sarcophagus, a mummy case you had already purchased, one you damaged by fire when the bitumen went up in flames. Easy enough to add a few inscriptions, particularly with a pet philologist to hand, I said, nodding at Fairbrother. Sir Leicester started to protest, but Fairbrother let out a gusty sigh.
Oh, for God's sake, Sir Leicester, we've had it. They have put all the pieces together and they know enough to hang us both.
Hang us!
The revolver in Sir Leicester's hand jumped wildly.
I shall not hang! I am no murderer!
Fairbrother's mouth twisted into a grotesque smile.
Do you think that matters? Do you think your title is going to save you when the story gets out? If you aren't hanged, you're disgraced, ruined forever. Unless I swear that you murdered Jonas Fowler,
he said, a cunning expression creeping over his face.
But I did no such thing,
Sir Leicester protested. Fairbrother shrugged.
Can you prove it? There was no post-mortem,
he pointed out.
Jonas died of heart failure after gastric trouble, a common thing when a man has been poisoned with arsenic. and there is a tidy packet of arsenic powder currently in your lady's possession. She cannot prove she took it from my room, can she? I shall say she took it from yours. If you lay the blame for De Morgan's murder on me, I shall lay blame for Fowler's on you.
But you cannot,
the baronet said, his voice thick with rage. His complexion was empurpled, and I wondered if he was about to have a second apoplexy.
I can, Fairbrother told him slowly. And I will, unless you agree here and now to take the blame for the planning of this endeavour. If neither of us admit to involvement in De Morgan's death, they cannot hang either one. We will spend our lives in prison, but we will live.
Sir Leicester looked frantically from Fairbrother to the rest of us. Stoker inched closer again, but Sir Leicester brandished the gun.
Back! You must stay back! I need to think!
He said, jabbing the weapon in Stoker's direction. It is all right, Sir Leicester, I said soothingly. You do not need to decide anything now. Give us the gun and let us take Fairbrother into the authorities. They will know best what to do. Sir Leicester looked confused. Beads of perspiration sprang out, beading the edge of his hairline. He panted a little, as if struggling to get his breath.
Sir Leicester,
Henry said gently,
you do not look well. Perhaps we ought to summon a doctor.
The word galvanized Sir Leicester.
No,
he said, holding up the gun with renewed vigor.
No, he is trying to manipulate me, but I will not have it. I know the truth, and the truth is that I would never have embarked upon this road were it not for him, and he intended to cheat me of my share. He means to flee to the Argentine, leaving me to clear up the mess. He has a ticket on a ship leaving tomorrow. Did you know that?
He demanded.
After all the sins we have committed, he means to add treachery to the list. But now he has been caught in his own web. He will lie and twist and connive, and he will go free. They will believe him because he is clever and I am not. Every evil that I have done has been at his instigation, and now I will atone for it,
he said. He lifted his chin with a quiet, desperate resolution.
No!
I cried. But of course it was too late. Before any of us could act, he lifted the gun and fired once. Patrick Fairbrother made no sound. He merely widened his eyes in astonishment, looked down to the crimson stain blossoming across his chest like a terrible flower. He fell to the floor in silence. A second shot followed hard upon the first, as Sir Leicester Tiverton pressed the revolver to the soft flesh just under his chin and pulled the trigger. Chapter 20. The suicide of the baronet and the murder of his expedition philologist only heightened the allure of the mummy's curse. Far from explaining away the tragic events as rational actions by a cruel conspiracy, the Daily Harbinger maintained that only the malign influence of a vengeful mummy could have driven Sir Leicester and Fairbrother to such desperate acts. It was nonsense, of course, but J.J. Butterworth's lurid prose did its work. Even knowing many of the artifacts to be fake, the public flocked to the Tiverton exhibition at Karnak Hall in astonishing numbers. A few days after our desperate flight into Surrey, we met Lady Tiverton at the Curiosity Club at her invitation. She was dressed in black now, and she seemed to have aged as she came forward to greet us. She was heavily veiled to avoid attracting attention, but she needn't have bothered. The members of the club took care of their own.
"Thank you for meeting me," she began.
We started in her direction, but Hetty, the portress, came out from behind her desk, stopping in front of Stoker with a firm step,
I am sorry, sir, but the Hippolyta Club does not permit gentlemen to enter.
Stoker cocked his head, and Lady Tiverton threw back her veil.
It is my fault, Hetty. I forgot the rules against gentlemen guests. I do not suppose you might bend them just this once?
Hetty surveyed Stoker from head to toe and gave a grudging nod.
Gentlemen may be admitted in extraordinary circumstances, but only to the parley room on the ground floor, and only for 29 minutes.
Stoker grinned.
That is terribly specific.
That, sir, is the rule. Stay a second longer, and I will come myself to escort you out,
she told him sternly. He inclined his head and trotted meekly behind as she showed us to the parley room. She pointedly turned an hourglass on the mantel and left it, sands slipping downwards as she took her leave, shutting the door firmly behind.
I am surprised that you want to see us, I told Lady Tiverton. We failed in our endeavour.
Her lips curved, but I would not have called it a smile. No smile was ever so sad.
You tried, Miss Speedwell. You tried to save him, and so did I. But he involved himself in the plot, and in the end, the responsibility for its dreadful conclusion must lie with him.
Her grave, dark eyes looked from me to Stoker and back again.
I know Figgy believed I betrayed her father with Patrick, but it is not true. I loved my husband very much, and I take my vows seriously, including the vow I made to the first Lady Tiverton to take care of Sir Leicester to the end of his life.
She saw you coming out of Fairbrother's room and misconstrued it. That was the first time you went looking for evidence against him, wasn't it?
Stoker asked, with a gentleness I had seldom heard him use. She nodded.
That was when I found the letter from his sister, confirming that John de Morgan had been dealt with.
She gave a little shudder and collected herself with a visible effort.
Forgive me. I want to talk about this. I want to hear it all said aloud, just this once. And then I never want to speak of it again.
She took a deep breath and began to speak.
I knew from the beginning of the season that something was amiss, but I could not say who was the author of the mischief. At first it seemed like nothing more than silly tricks. De Morgan's camera plates damaged, the sightings of Anubis. Destructive and demoralizing, but not malevolent. And then Jonas Fowler died, and I did not know what to think. He was ill, he had been for several years, and the demands of excavation life are strenuous. I did not want to believe that anyone might have hastened his death.
"Do you believe it now?"
he asked.
She spread her hands. Her wedding ring caught the light. She would wear it always, I was certain.
The chemist's envelope I found in Patrick's room. There was only a trace of powder left in it, and no way to tell what it might have been. I do not want to believe he might have... even now...
She broke off, covering her mouth. It was arsenic, I told her gently. He admitted it just before his death, but he would not confess to using it on Jonas Fowler. In fact, he was prepared to swear the packet belonged to you and that you had a hand in Mr. Fowler's death. But with no post-mortem, I let the sentence trail off. She was silent, clearly struggling with strong emotion. After a moment she composed herself.
So we will never know if poor Jonas was the first of his victims. Perhaps it is best. I like to think Jonas died as he lived,
giving all of himself to the adopted country he loved. Let him rest in peace. I had my own thoughts upon the subject. The fact that Fairbrother had been so willing to arrange John de Morgan's death when it suited him made it clear he would not have balked at easing Jonas Fowler's passage into the next world. But if he had, Fairbrother had paid for his crimes, and Lady Tiverton needed no fresh horrors. She paused again, and when she began to speak she sounded older, resigned to the burden of grief she would carry to the end of her days.
I have seen evil, and it wears a smiling face. I liked him when he first came to us, she said, her expression soft with reminiscence. I realized soon after our marriage that Sir Leicester and I were not to be blessed with children, but he liked young people. It made him feel youthful to have them around. I encouraged Patrick. I thought he showed great promise, and over time they became close. So close that when Sir Leicester discovered the cave last year, it was to Patrick that he confided his find, and not to me. And Patrick, who suggested the use to which it might profitably be put? I suggested. She nodded. I think so. It is not the sort of plot Sir Leicester would have contrived on his own. It took planning, audacity. Certainly my husband was audacious, but methodical he was not. Someone had to arrange for the faked antiquities to be made and shipped out of Egypt, and someone had to arrange for them to be received in Dover and sent on to the house in Surrey.
Fairbrother's sister, Stoker said. We made her acquaintance.
She was the one who murdered John de Morgan, Lady Tiverton said. On his orders. Her letter revealed that he had sent very specific instructions as to how the deed was to be done. She complied. She was his willing accomplice in every way, and I can only imagine the hold he must have had over her to force her to do such terrible things.
I remembered Mrs. Giddens and her cold-blooded treatment of Stoker and of me, and I smiled thinly. I do not think Mrs. Giddens requires much persuasion. She and her brother are two of a kind. He had spoken to me of her once, and with real affection, the self-sacrificing sister who had done everything to make certain her beloved brother was given every opportunity. She had not even scrupled at murder to ensure his success. Lady Tiverton nodded.
Her letter indicated that he was the one who schemed to spirit away the body in the sarcophagus, knowing the authorities would never look inside. Mrs. Giddens had only to store the corpse in her wash-house for a few days until we arrived from Egypt. Patrick did the rest. He put John's remains in the sarcophagus, and we brought it with us, never knowing.
All that talk of a mummy, and it never existed, I murmured. Princess Ankerset was a fiction from start to finish, just a few faked hieroglyphs on a mummy case and a diadem.
It was an audacious plan, Lady Tiverton said, her voice tight. It might have worked.
We were silent a moment before I raised the subject of Patrick Fairbrother again. It was his idea to redecorate the room, was it not? In order to confuse and terrify Caroline de Morgan. No one would believe her story because she would sound mad, and with de Morgan gone under mysterious circumstances, the easiest explanation was that he had stolen the diadem for his own gain. She nodded.
It was monstrous. The police say that Mrs. Giddens has disappeared from Dover. They have no idea of where she has gone, but they are quite certain she has quitted the country.
A wanted murderess? No doubt she has put as much distance between England and herself as possible.
Stoker agreed.
And her brother has paid for his crimes.
I thought of Patrick Fairbrother, the clever, grasping young scholar with the charming smile and the winsome ways. I was not often slow to suspect evil in a man who was capable of it. My life had, upon occasion, depended upon my ability to tell villainy from virtue. I should not soon forget my failure here.
Yes, he has paid. As has my husband,
Lady Tiverton said with some bitterness.
Poor, foolish Leicester.
What drove him to it? I asked. He was a man who had every advantage.
Money,
she said simply.
The first, Lady Tiverton, divided her fortune evenly between her husband and her child. Sir Leicester ran through his half.
Egyptology is a messy and expensive business, she added with a rueful smile. He thought that one great find would make his name, and he was right. If he had discovered a tomb of note, he would have made a fortune. As it was, he intended to sell worthless trinkets for enormous sums to amateurs who would not know the difference.
But you did, I observed. What raised your suspicions?
The sarcophagus, she said promptly. It was the one thing he could not afford to fake. With a genuine mummy case, the rest of the find would have received far less scrutiny. He took a sarcophagus that he had purchased some years ago, and, with Patrick's help, contrived to make it appear authentic to the Princess Ankeset. I did not recognize it at first, because of the alterations, but something troubled me about it. Eventually, I thought to compare the Princess Ankeset's sarcophagus to a photograph the first Lady Tiverton had in her collection of the pieces Sir Leicester had bought. The parts that were not altered or damaged in the fire were a perfect match. And the fire was a deliberate attempt to damage the sarcophagus and make it untraceable, I deduced. She nodded. A bit of bitumen and the fire damage covered up the places where they were unable to change the previous inscriptions. They thought it would be enough, but I suspect I would not have been the only one to realize the fraud in time. What of the beautiful pectoral piece you wore to the reception, the one Sir Leicester claimed to have excavated?
Worthless, she said briskly. Except as a conversation piece. And the diadem of the princess?
Stoker asked. A modern forgery, not worth anything more than the weight of the gold and the gems. About the diadem, I began. She held up a hand. Mr. Steele has kindly returned it. I have sent it back to him to keep in trust for Figgy. It is not worth a tremendous amount, but it is something. I blinked at her in surprise.
In trust for Figgy?
Her smile was thin.
My husband was superstitious about things like wills. He only ever made one, during his first marriage. As the previous Lady Tiverton was wealthy in her own right, he provided only a token amount for his widow. The provisions for Figgy remain unchanged. In the event of his death, Figgy is to be given into the care of Horace Steele, along with the management of her inheritance. I could possibly make a case in court, but such a thing would be doubtful at best, and terribly expensive. I am content to accept the situation as it is.
But you are her stepmother, Stoker argued. You ought to have charge of the girl.
She shook her head.
Figgy blames me for too much of what has happened.
That is unjust,
he told her. The young are often unjust. But in time I hope she will come to see that I am not the villainess she believed. I did everything in my power to save my husband from ruin. Instead, I caused it.
How?
Stoker asked. I gave my husband the steamship ticket I found in Patrick's room. That was what drove him to rise from his sickbed and go to confront him. He found Patrick in the action of preparing to flee.
It was his own choice to take matters into his own hands,
Stoker reminded her gently.
He might have turned Fairbrother over to the authorities.
For murder, yes, and confessed himself as a fraud, dragging his family name through the mud, condemning his daughter to a lifetime of whispers. No, bless him. He tried to spare her that. But, as I said, my husband was not much of a thinker. She rose and extended her hand to each of us in turn. I am leaving for Egypt just as soon as I can make the arrangements. I do not believe we will meet again. We emerged from the parley room with 6 minutes to spare. Hetty gave Stoker a close look as we walked past, and he tipped his hat to her. Miss Speedwell, she called. A moment? She emerged from behind the desk, holding a vellum portfolio. We received your acceptance. You will be inducted at the next formal meeting, in a fortnight's time. Here is the information for new members. It is confidential. I took the heavy vellum portfolio. I glanced at the wall where the photographs of the members were hung. Past and present they were arranged, a gallery of women of accomplishment, women of stalwart spirit and indomitable courage. And in spite of my misgivings, I knew I had found a home. Just at the end there was a small, empty spot, not prominent, tucked just beneath the stairs. Right there, I told Hetty. Pardon, Miss Speedwell? That is where I want my photograph to hang. She grinned. Welcome to the Curiosity Club, Miss Speedwell. The next afternoon, Lady Welly invited us to tea to hear the final report of what she insisted upon calling the Tiverton case.
Poor messy Lessie, she said,
as she added a hefty measure of whiskey to her tea. Stoker had cried off on the grounds that he was attempting repairs to the aerostat Réveillon, but I suspected it would be futile. His lordship had taken one look at the wagon-load of splintered wicker and torn taffeta, and turned away in despair. Still, Stoker felt obligated to try, and so he was busy stitching and gluing and weaving under the Earl's watchful eye.
"What is to become of Figgy?"
Lady Welly asked.
"School,"
I told her promptly. We had spent the previous evening dining at the Allerdale Hotel in Mr. Steele's suite, discussing the situation. At my urging, Mr. Steele enrolled Figgy in the Laidlaw Upton Academy for Young Ladies, a unique establishment in Colorado founded to nurture the gumption of unusual young women. It was no secret that he harbored a hope that one day she would make up her mind to marry young Henry, but I encouraged her to give it 10 years and travel the world at least twice before taking such a drastic step. She thanked me for my advice with a reluctant handshake. To Stoker she entrusted Newt, the hound, explaining that she could not take him to America and that the animal could ask for no better place than at Stoker's side. It took a concerted effort and all my strength to pry Figgy off Stoker when she went to hug him goodbye, but at last she was removed from his person and we were allowed to get on with our evening.
Lady Welly nodded as I related the story.
It will be the making of her. She might look like a Tiverton, but she's a ward, and if she's anything like her mother, she will show it now. Adversity builds character, she finished briskly. Speaking of one's parents, this arrived today.
She handed over a small box of black kid, stamped on the top with a trio of distinctive feathers.
Are those... Yes, his feathers. Open it.
I did as she bade me. Inside, nestled on a bed of oyster satin, was the slender strand of beads from the Tiverton exhibition. The blue lapis butterfly dangled from the bottom, poised as if to fly away. I did not touch it. Lady Welly spoke first.
It is one of the few pieces that are genuine. Don't worry. He paid for it. The going rate.
Why? I asked, in a voice unlike my own.
Who can say? She replied with a shrug. There was no note with it, only the instruction to see it delivered into your hands. Take whatever meaning you like from it.
I closed the box. And if I do not take it at all?
That is also your choice, she acknowledged. But do not close the door entirely, Veronica.
He has closed it upon me often enough, I countered quickly. Too quickly. She gave me a pitying smile.
Do not ever let your pride dictate your principles, child.
I put the box into my pocket and took up the teapot. I think you need a fresh cup, I said. And when I poured, my hand was steady. I left Lady Welly and made my way to the Belvedere, lost in thought, and had reached my desk before I realized I was not alone. Good afternoon, Mrs. De Morgan. I am afraid Stoker is busy with his work, but I can send someone to find him for you if you like. She gave me a coolly appraising look.
I do not want to speak to him. I came to see you.
Whatever for?
Because you are the one who found John.
Her voice broke on his name.
I can bury him decently, and that is worth something at least.
I am sorry for your loss, I told her.
My loss?
Her eyes were bleak.
What do you know of loss? Have you ever been in love? Not calf love, Miss Speedwell, I mean proper love. The kind that is not sweet or tender but burns in your bones and tears you in two. That is what I felt for John. We fought like devils, but that was our way. No one understood that when we quarreled we felt alive. God, how I shall miss the savagery of our life together. He was not a good man. But he was good to me.
I thought then of all they had destroyed between them, and my blood ran hot through my temples.
Perhaps you should use that as an epitaph, I suggested.
You despise me, Miss Speedwell, but you do not even know me,
she said, curling a scornful lip. But I do know you. I have always known you. You belong to that contemptible breed of female who will forever look at what she has been denied, rather than what she has been given. What gift has nature refused you? You were born under a fairy star. Beauty, breeding, good health, native intelligence. These were yours from birth. But what gratitude have you ever expressed for them? None. You rise from your bed every day on two strong legs and can think only to complain that someone once spoke harshly to you. You had parents who reared you gently, but you scorn them for being poor. You who have lived abroad and seen real want. Tell me, Mrs. De Morgan,
When you were in Egypt, did you ever look at a woman laboring in the fields and understand that it was the merest accident of a kind providence that you were not born to toil your life away? Have you ever looked a starving beggar in the eye and thought that the privileges you enjoy are nothing more than a whim of the cosmos? You are fortune's darling, beloved of the gods, blessed with every advantage, but you are blind and deaf to your endowments. You have ease and comfort, but you do not live. You merely exist because you appreciate nothing. Waken, Mrs. De Morgan, or else you will slumber your life away. She rose.
You think you are clever, Miss Speedwell. You think you are so much smarter than I am. But I will tell you something you ought to know. You have befriended a dangerous man. Revelstoke has killed a man. Think about that. He has taken those useful, talented hands of his and used them to crush the life out of someone. That should make the marrow in your bones run cold. How can you stand to be near him now that you know he has taken a life?
She demanded, her eyes cruel in her triumph. I moved closer to her, giving her a slow smile, a tiger's smile. Because, Mrs. De Morgan, I have taken two. The day after Caroline De Morgan's visit, I went into the glasshouse to find that my lunar moths had emerged. They had broken free from their dark little prisons, pushing forth on damp, silken wings. As I watched in rapt wonder, they spread them slowly, drying them as they flapped back and forth. They were pale green with long, elegant hind wings and markings like eyes that seemed to watch me as I studied them. They were large, each exceeding the length of my hand. One by one they rose from their branches, testing themselves as they lifted into the warm, humid air of the glasshouse, attempting their freedom for the first time. Each silken wing was edged in cerise, and the antennae were frilled and golden, frivolous little embellishments that danced above their bodies.
"They've closed,"
Stoker observed, coming to stand behind me. I nodded, marveling as the last moth flitted off in amorous pursuit of a mate.
"I received word this morning. John De Morgan's child was born last night, well before its time. A girl," he said quietly. "That, no doubt, came as a nasty shock to her mother."
"And Caroline? How is she?"
"Well enough, although the child may not survive."
"If she does, I am glad she is a girl. Her mother will have no claim upon the De Morgan money," I said, with a touch of asperity.
"No. She will have to leave off her machinations for now. As soon as they are able, they mean to move to the country."
I turned, but his face gave nothing away. Did it pain him to speak of her? Still, he did not say her name, had never willingly said it in front of me. And suddenly the words I had never planned to speak fell from my lips.
"Why do you never say her name? I have only once heard you speak the word Caroline. Does she torment you so much?"
His expression was one of astonishment. Then he smiled.
"No. I do not say it, because I never called her that except upon one occasion, on our wedding night, just before she refused me her bed. I kissed her and called her by her given name. It was, I believed then, the happiest moment of my life. One perfect golden moment before it all went to hell."
I turned away. That was what it meant, then. The invoking of her name when he was drugged and half delirious and his mouth was on mine. He was remembering not the woman who had come before, but the promise of happiness he had glimpsed once, and never thought to know again. I cleared my throat and brushed aside a stray leaf. He stood in front of me, very close. He reached out, putting a fingertip to the pendant at my throat.
A handsome little butterfly. I don't remember seeing this before.
It is new, I told him. There would be time enough to explain. He went on, still touching the lapis butterfly, his knuckles just grazing the skin of my chest.
The case has been put to rest now. John is buried, and whatever was left of my reputation has been salvaged,
he said, his voice oddly soft.
Thank you for that. You fight harder for me than you would ever do for yourself. Why?
Because there is no power on earth that could make me abandon our friendship. There is no deed you could confess so dark that it would make me forsake you. You said of us once that we were quicksilver and the rest of the world mud. We are alike, shaped by nature in the same mould, and whatever that signifies, it means that to spurn each other would be to spit in the face of whatever deity has seen fit to bring us together. We are the same. And to leave you would be to leave myself. Make of that what you will. I turned away to watch my lunars rising and swooping amidst the iron lacework overhead. Hunting butterflies requires an oblique approach. If one charges them directly, they flit away, mapping a mazy, elusive path until they disappear from sight, with a final flap of jeweled, defiant wings. But if one is cunning and careful, it is possible to approach them so subtly they do not realize you are upon them until the net descends. The trick is to move with them, parallel but not intersecting, guiding them gently to a suitable landing spot where they can be captured without injury. The timing is all. Hurry them, and they will bolt. Dawdle, and they will dart away after some tasty sip of nectar. It requires patience, skill, and resolve. Qualities I had in abundance, and which Stoker would give me ample opportunity to exercise. I turned back to him, words that I thought never to say to any man rising to my lips. At that moment, a voice hailed us from just beyond the little grove of hornbeams. I closed my mouth and stepped away.
Miss Speedwell, I received your message. Have the little devils finally emerged?
It was the Viscount, with impeccable manners and deplorable timing. Good morning, my lord, I called brightly. Stoker and I are just admiring them now.
Oh, is my brother with you?
The Viscount asked, pushing his way through the foliage.
Yes,
Stoker told him, coming to stand behind me, his hand grazing my waist.
I am.
The End. This is Angèle Mersters. We hope you have enjoyed this production of A Treacherous Curse by Deanna Raeburn. Recorded Books offers a wide selection of bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more. So look for us at your public library or on download sites online. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.